Welcome back to the program. Success, in William James' phrase, demands strange sacrifices from those who worship her. In today's complex times, one of those sacrifices is the ability to be willing to fail. Someone deep in the corporate world once said to me in response to a question about lack of performance that you can get into a lot of trouble by not doing anything, but you can get in even more trouble by doing something. The fact is that in today's high-speed, high-complexity world, not doing something is not an option. Acting and not being afraid of failure is the only way to succeed today. We're going to talk about this with my guest, Tim Harford. He's the undercover economist at the Financial Times of London. His writing has also appeared in Esquire, New York Magazine, Wired, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. He's the author of the previous books, The Undercover Economist and The Logic of Life. It is my pleasure to have Tim Harford here to talk about his latest work, Adapt, Why Success Always Starts with Failure. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much. Nice to be on the show again.
Good to have you here. First of all, this notion of not being afraid to fail, is that more important, do you believe, given the complexity of both the problems and the issues that we face today in business and in our lives?
Well, I think so. I think your introduction put it very well. The quote from your colleague in business who said, you know, you can really get into trouble for doing things. I think the problem that we face is failure is basically inevitable. I'm not saying failure is a great thing. I'm not saying, oh, it's a one, you know, failure makes you a grown-up. Failure is this wonderful learning experience, and you should go out and seek failure. What I'm saying is failure is going to come and find you because the world is too complex to take any action without the risk of failure. 10% of American businesses go bankrupt every year. It's just too hard. There's too much going on. And so we're going to fail. So the question is, how can we turn that failure to our advantage? And part of it, I think, is a willingness to fail early on a small scale rather than just wait until the big failures hit us. Very interesting to contrast Silicon Valley, where they talk about, you know, fail faster, with Wall Street, where they talk about too big to fail, and ask yourselves which section of the economy has been more productive.
Right. It's interesting when we look at the corporate world and the attitudes towards failure and the analogous to how individuals approach it in their lives. When we're youthful and we're young, not unlike Silicon Valley and the technology world, we're willing to fail, we're willing to try new things, and oftentimes when we're older and more mature, we're willing to take risks because we understand what the consequences of failure might be and that they're not totally devastating. It's that kind of middle-age period where the fear of failure seems the most intense.
I think so. I think back to one of the happiest times in my life, and it was full of failure. It was when I was a college student. I think many people who've been lucky enough to be college students, many of them had a great time. And when you actually think about what you were doing was you were experimenting and therefore failing, because all experimentation brings failure. You were experimenting in a very safe space. You know, you could be experimenting with new friends, maybe experimenting with boyfriends and girlfriends for the first time. You might be experimenting with drugs. You're certainly experimenting with a new place, with new ideas, new hobbies. I mean, it's just an incredibly rich time for people, and many, many failures. And yet, at the end of it, your 3 years or your 4 years, you're going to do your exams, and you're going to go off and you'll get your job. And as long as you didn't push it too far, it's an incredibly safe place to do that. And the first couple of years at your first job, in principle, it seems like they could be the same, right? Again, you're probably in a new city. You're learning new skills. You've got new colleagues, new challenges. And for many of us, those first couple of years having a job couldn't be more different from being a student, couldn't be more miserable. They certainly were miserable for me. And it was because the feeling that you were allowed to fail had just completely evaporated. You felt that there was no room to fail, there was no room to experiment, and all that was left was just a really miserable, impoverished existence.
Part of it is that we settle into a comfort zone, both in terms of what companies do and what individuals do, that mitigate against failure and against risk-taking at certain points.
Yeah, I mean, and clearly Nobody likes to fail. Well, actually, that's not quite true. There do seem to be companies who are perfectly happy to fail. So Google is one of them. I know it's a little bit lazy just to say, well, everyone should be like Google, but still, it's a very admired company. It's fascinating to notice the tactics they've used to encourage failure and experimentation. So that's all the way right at the top. You've got people like Vice President Marissa Meyer who says 80% of our products will fail, and that's fine, because the 20% that succeed will create all the revenue, create all the profits, no problem. Pushing it all the way down to the lowliest engineer, any engineer at Google gets to take one day a week to work on his or her own projects or projects that their peers have launched that they admire. So that's from top to bottom an experimental, failure-friendly approach. Now, not every corporation can be like Google, but it's interesting to see that they're so proud to experiment and to risk failure. And many, many other companies don't seem to be so willing to do so, and clearly not doing as well.
Is part of the problem today that there is so much of a spotlight on what businesses are doing, whether they're in the technology field or the car field or whatever it might be? There's so much of a spotlight and so much short-term thinking that failure becomes something that leaders are afraid of.
Well, I think the short-term thinking is more of the problem than the spotlight. I think failure can stand media spotlight if it's managed in the right way. It's all about setting up expectations. What people will not accept is clumsy or unethical behavior or arrogance. Pride goes before a fall. You know, we love to bring down a company that is boasting. But if a company says, well, we're launching this new line of business, we'll see how it works, we've got this new product, that, I think, is perfectly acceptable. I think as long as the expectations are set in advance, that's fine. And, you know, I think that's true for politics as well. I wish politicians didn't take the advice that you quoted at the beginning of the program so seriously. Politicians often feel they will be punished by the media and certainly by their opponents if they do any single thing that is identifiably a failure. They can have 50 successful policies, but one failure, and that will be the subject of the next election campaign. I think if politicians were to say, hey, I've got some ideas for improving our schools, for instance, we're going to try out pilots, half a dozen new ideas. We don't think they'll all work, but we think they're all promising. We're going to give them a try, and whichever ones work, we'll back them. I think if that sort of thing's announced in advance, voters will understand. But usually what happens is politicians absolutely refuse to set targets, to be evaluated. They try to avoid experimenting. And if they are caught experimenting and caught failing, then they're punished.
Of course, the other part of that is to define what constitutes success and failure and what kind of metrics we're using. If we're only using quarterly earnings numbers, it's very different than what have we learned from this failure that might help us down the road.
Absolutely. So think about one of the most powerful technologies for controlled failure in Western civilization, the randomized controlled trial. With this technology has created modern medicine. I don't think that's an exaggeration to say it's made modern medicine possible and all the good things that come from modern medicine. And what is the technology? It's very simple. You give a treatment to a bunch of people and you give no treatment or possibly an existing limited treatment, but quite possibly no treatment at all to a second bunch of people, the control group. And that is a controlled failure. But that's absolutely fine. We don't think of it as a failure when there's a trial for a new drug. The fact that half the people aren't getting the drug and may not get better as a result, we don't think of that as a failure. We think of that as part of the process of learning. But in most situations, we just don't view it the same way. We just say, well, they tried it. It didn't work. What a stupid idea. And that's a real shame.
What about businesses? I mentioned the auto industry before. What about businesses where it is more difficult to create prototypes, to create modeling, to create essentially survivable failure?
I think that's a very good question. And in those businesses, clearly, we must be a lot more cautious. And we need to be the amount of failure you can tolerate depends on the industry that you're in. So I talked approvingly about Google. Google puts out products in the cloud like Gmail and tweaks them and tweaks them and tweaks them. Ford Motor Company can't put out a car in beta with brakes that don't work and then tweak it. I mean, that's just impossible. So, you know, we have to have different standards. One of the things I looked at for the book was experts in safety engineering. I looked at Deepwater Horizon as a case study. I looked at Three Mile Island as a case study. The big industrial process accidents with very serious consequences, and tried to understand how those the risks of in those industries are contained. And I tried to then apply the learning to Wall Street, because, frankly, it's not just a metaphor to say Wall Street's like a nuclear reactor on the verge of meltdown. It's actually a very, very useful analogy. You learn a couple of things. So one is, if you can make the system simpler and more decoupled, in other words, so a failure can be contained, that's very useful for its own sake, whether we're talking about a nuclear reactor or whether we're talking about Wall Street. And the second lesson is whistleblowing is very important. Listening to whistleblowers is very important, again, whether we're talking about industrial accidents or finance, because often the catastrophic failure that we all fear will have precedence. There will have been smaller failures along the line, and whistleblowers will often know, or potential whistleblowers will often know, that there's been a failure. There was a wrong bet made. We're relying, the credit ratings don't work, or somebody's left a valve in the wrong place, or somebody hasn't checked the blowout preventer. And we need to listen to those whistleblowers before it's too late.
What about the cultural framework for all of this? As you look at it from the perspective of Europe, for example, do you see a different attitude there than say, here in America?
I think so. I think when it comes to business, Europe is far less forgiving of failure. We don't have the same startup culture. There isn't the idea that having set up a small company and failed is a badge of honor. It shows you've learned something. So I think when it comes to the private sector, Europe just doesn't have the same entrepreneurialism, which is a real shame. I wonder, though, when it comes to public policy experiments, I wonder whether some parts of Europe are a little more willing to trust the technocrats to experiment and to run pilots and to learn. I certainly feel that it should be something where the market will experiment and fail automatically. But I do feel we need more of that culture in our political institutions.
Of course, on the other side of that, we see what happened in the financial crisis with institutions that were arguably too large to fail.
Absolutely. And these were, it's worth asking yourself, how does a market normally work when it's working well? Lots and lots of diverse experiments. A high failure rate, but all, it doesn't matter. In fact, there's a positive correlation between the failure rate in an economy and the growth rate in an economy. And a sort of pretty clear marker, you know, this business has failed, it needs to be closed down, and somebody else will come along and take over. Compare that with Wall Street. There was no pluralism. All these banks were making the same stupid bets at the same time. There was no sense of small failures. These were huge, huge bets. I calculated at the height of the credit crunch, there were 1.25 quadrillion, which is over a million billion dollars worth of outstanding derivatives contracts. Huge, huge bets. So no sense of small failure. And third, no sense that you could spot the failure happening early. These bets were made, and traders were being rewarded for making the bets, and it might be 2 or 3 years afterwards suddenly the chickens came home to roost. So Wall Street was bizarre. It was a market that simply didn't experiment in a safe way the way normal markets do. And I think if we can make Wall Street more safely experimental, with more pluralism, smaller scale failures, clear identification of failures early, it'll be a lot safer.
With respect to identification of failures, an important part of this is being willing to admit failure, being willing to not be in denial and admit when something doesn't work and make the appropriate changes.
That's absolutely right. And although the book is mostly about how we solve these problems on a large scale, in organizations, whether we're talking about companies or the U.S. Army or governmental organizations, it is also a problem on the personal scale. Psychologically, we struggle with failure. We don't respond well to it. I interviewed poker players for this book, and they they told me that the time you're most vulnerable is immediately after you've suffered a failure at the poker table, because then you start doing stupid things in a vain attempt, a counterproductive attempt to make up for the failure. So there's one psychological weakness we have when it comes to failure. And the second psychological weakness we have is denial. Failure hurts. Even small failure hurts. It's embarrassing. It hurts our pride to acknowledge that we failed. And so we get very good at denying that we've failed. And we also tend to surround ourselves socially with people who help us maintain that denial. So if you're a chief executive, you'll probably be surrounded by yes men who tell you you're doing a great job. In everyday life, you will surround yourself with friends. And, of course, we all have the occasional friend who'll tell us some home truths, but generally not. Generally, if we've had a run-in with our boss at work, we get together for drinks with a few friends, and the friends will tell us, yeah, the boss is an idiot, of course he didn't do anything wrong, of course it's all his fault, and maybe they're thinking to themselves, well, actually, sounds like the boss had a point, but I'm not going to be the person who breaks the bad news, because I know how it'll be received. It won't be received well.
Big part of this is, it seems to me, is the willingness to understand that change is a constant, that everything that we do is subject to change, new ways of looking at it, new ways of doing it, and that we not just settle into routine. And that's really tough for people.
It is. I quote Andy Warhol talking about Coca-Cola. Remember, he has that great quote about Coca-Cola.
Right.
He says, all the Cokes are the same and all the Cokes are good. And I think we sort of want that for the rest of our lives. We want all our political institutions to be the same and all good. We want all our experiences to all be the same and all good. And, you know, they just can't be. Coca-Cola is a solved problem. It's a sort of sweet, fizzy drink. We know how to make it. So that problem's been solved, and we don't need to change that. But in most other parts of life, for various reasons, whether because of economic changes or because of technological changes or simply because we grow older and people move on, we need to change. And to respond well to that change, we need to experiment. And to experiment, we need to risk failing. And risking failing is something we just hate to do.
And even Coca-Cola was willing to take a risk with something like the new Coke and failed.
Yeah, and they went back, and I think probably in the long run that did them no harm at all. I mean, there are miracles of experimentation in the Coca-Cola company when you think about new products or particularly about delivering Coca-Cola all over the world. I mean, that's an incredibly dynamic, adaptive process. But, you know, the basic Coca-Cola problem, that's been solved. Nobody wants it to change, and that's fine. But that's unusual. I mean, that's why Andy Warhol talked about Coca-Cola as though it was unusual. But we seem to think that, you know, we can have the Coca-Cola experience, sort of uniformity and unchangingness. And I just don't think we can in most parts of our lives.
Is there something about all of this that we have been talking about, Tim, that is at core kind of antithetical to human nature?
In a sense, I think it is. We form our tastes as toddlers. We experiment a lot as teenagers, but as adults, we learn not to take risks, to avoid even small risks. And that is probably something to do with the ancestral environment on which we evolved, where risk-taking is probably not smart. The downside is much bigger than the upside. But, you know, in the modern world, I think risk-taking, sensible risk-taking, is smart. The upside is big. The downside is not so serious. And so we need to sort of fight against this risk-averse part of ourselves and fight against our unwillingness to admit failure. But, you know, I think we can do it. And if we're honest, a willingness to experiment, a willingness to try new things, a willingness to risk failure, I think that is also a very human thing. And I think if we're willing to do those things, we can enjoy richer lives as a result.
Mm-hmm. Well, you use the example of the American military, and you know, the joke always is the American military is always fighting the next war with the lessons that it learned from the last one. Sometimes that's good, sometimes bad.
There's a fantastic quote in a book by John Nagle, a counterinsurgency expert, about Vietnam. The senior officer says, you know, I'll be damned if I will let the U.S. Army destroy its traditions and its doctrines just to win this war. So he recognized there was a choice. You can change the army beyond recognition and win the war in Vietnam, or you can keep keep it the way you like it, and you'll lose the war in Vietnam. And he made the choice he'd rather lose. And when I studied what happened in Iraq, it was quite striking. There were very brave men, quite far down the chain of command, I'm talking about colonels and majors, who were not willing to let the U.S. Army lose the war by refusing to change. One of them, H.R. McMaster, right. Who was repeatedly passed over for promotion, was actually a historian who'd studied the failures in Vietnam. So these guys adapted the U.S. Army from the bottom up. They weren't willing to let it make those mistakes, but it took a tremendously long time, and you know, the fact that it took so long was a tragedy.
Is there a fundamental difference in all of this in terms of creative endeavors, and you use Twyla Tharp and some other examples, creative endeavors versus more business-oriented endeavors?
I think even businesses can experiment very productively. And I think many businesses would say that they were creative. I mean, it's certainly true that you don't... With theatre or dance, you probably need to be different and original for originality's sake, whereas McDonald's can just basically keep on making the same hamburgers and people will keep buying the same hamburgers and it doesn't need to innovate a lot. But I think this is true of all walks of life. The real distinction I would make is that there are some systems, we talked about nuclear power, we talked about finance, where the downside is very large and the upside is small for experimentation. And there it's all about controlling failure and restricting failure. But I think in most parts of life, there's a big upside from successful experiments. The downside is not as serious as we think. And you know, we can learn lessons. One of the fun things about writing the book was to see the lessons learned on the front line in Iraq actually having some bearing on the way ordinary businesses run themselves, or to look at the history of medicine and to realize that tells us something about the way we give foreign aid. I mean, those parallels were very powerful for me.
Then, of course, there's the ability not only to learn from our own failure, but to closely look at the failure of others and learn from that experience.
It's certainly a lot less painful if you can learn from other people's failures. And one of the easy things, of course, is when you look at someone else's failure, you don't suffer the same denial of reality. You know, it's often easier to be objective. If you can learn from someone else's mistakes, that's better than learning from your own. I think the only trouble with that, Jeff, is that I quote Hayek in my book. Hayek has this wonderful phrase, the particular circumstances of time and place. The world's very complex. Every situation is just a little bit different. Every case is just a little bit different. And so I think we usually find that although we have our theories and our preconceptions and we have lessons learned from watching others, in the end, when we have to make complex decisions, there will usually be something unique about those decisions. And that means we're going to have to make a few of our own mistakes on the way through. But certainly, if you can avoid that, if you can learn from someone else's mistakes rather than learning from your own, well, that's certainly better.
And that really kind of brings us around to where we started in terms of one of the things that makes failure virtually inevitable and why we need to embrace it is the sheer complexity of everything we deal with today.
Yes, I start the book with a little story about a toaster and this wonderful experiment. Somebody wanted to try and make a toaster by himself, you know, armed only with a penknife. And it turns out even a toaster, which costs about $7, is a tremendously complex product. It's got over 400 components and subcomponents, lots and lots of different materials. There are probably 10 billion distinct products and services in, say, the California economy. 10 billion different types of products and services, and many of them are much more complex than a toaster. So the economy we've surrounded ourselves with, and then by extension, the society that supports that economy, is just tremendously complex. I think we don't face up to how complex it is because it's just a little bit terrifying. But problems in that economy get solved all the time. But they get solved by trial and error. They get solved by experimentation. And they get solved with a pretty hefty dose of failure.
Tim Harford, the book is Adapt, Why Success Always Starts with Failure. It's just out from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Tim, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much, Jeff.